About 10 to 15 million people around the world have type 1 diabetes and require insulin to make up for the pancreas's inability to produce enough for the body's use. In the September 28, 2006 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, researchers from the University of Alberta studied the clinical outcomes of transplanting insulin-producing cells, or islet cells, into people with type 1 diabetes. And I'm pleased to introduce Dr. James Shapiro, who's director of the Clinical Islet Transplant Program at the University of Alberta and Clinical Research Professorial Chair in Transplantation. Good afternoon.
Hi, Barry. It's great to be with you.
Can you trace the history of islet cell transplant research? What has been learned up to this point?
Okay. The history of islet transplantation is actually completely fascinating. And although we've made phenomenal progress in the last 5 to 6 years, people were tinkering with the concept of transplanting insulin-producing tissues for a long time. In fact, it goes back to 1893, when a surgeon in Bristol in England and his medical colleagues, so Watson Williams and Mr. Harsant, they took a 13-year-old boy came to the hospital dying from the ravages of diabetes, and the boy was in ketoacidosis. This is more than 25 years before the discovery of insulin, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So there was no effective treatment for his condition. So they took a sheep's pancreas, and they sliced it up into little pieces, each the size and shape of a Brazil nut, and put it under his skin. And in fact, this was probably the very first xenograft of foreign tissue transplanted into a patient. Now, of course, it was destined to be rejected in a very rapid time frame, but there was a slight amelioration in the boy's condition before he died. And then in 1916, in Newcastle in England, there was a surgeon by the name of Frederick Charles Pybus, who tried to transplant human tissue this time, human cadaveric pancreas, into a patient also dying from diabetes. And again, there was improvement in the urine and blood sugar before the patient died. And then there was, of course, the insulin came along in the 1920s, and there was really no need for a transplantation because all of a sudden a cure for diabetes, effectively, at least they thought at the time, had been found. And then it was very clear following that, that although insulin provided a palliation for patients with at least type 1 diabetes, it didn't provide a cure, and patients were left with many long-term and life-shortening serious complications, the blindness, the kidney failure, the strokes, the heart disease, etc. And so then the possibility of islet transplantation became revisited again in the early 1970s. There was a pathologist by the name of Paul E. Lacey, who was really interested in doing some physiological studies of islets initially, and so he was able to take islets out of mice and rats. And he thought, well, what happens if I transplant these purified islets? And he transplanted them, and he was able to completely ameliorate, correct the diabetic state in a chemically diabetic mouse and rat. And that was really the milestone I wouldn't call it the modern era of islet transplantation, but it was really the concept that really suggested that islet transplant could work. And then following that, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, there were some clinical attempts at islet transplantation. And I think there was a report in 1990 where one patient came off insulin for a period of about three and a half weeks. And then the cells were completely rejected, and the patient had to go back on insulin. And then from there, up until 1999-2000, there were about 450 attempts at clinical islet transplants in patients. But very, very few of these transplants worked. It was like, Halley's Comet. So it would be so rare to see a patient who was completely free of insulin that it was less than 10%, less than 8% of these transplants worked even for short periods of time. And then in 1999, we began tinkering with and developing the Edmonton Protocol and transplanted the first seven patients with that, reported our findings in the New England Journal of Medicine in the year 2000. And this new protocol really tried to address why was it that all the previous transplants had failed. And we reckoned it was partly related to the way the islets had been prepared, and we therefore added two or occasionally three donor pancreas worth of islets into a patient, so putting more islets than were transplanted previously. And we also realized that the drugs that were used to prevent rejection were also probably some of the causes of why the transplants didn't work. In other words, high doses of steroids given to patients to prevent rejection. We know that the steroids, for example, can cause diabetes, as can high doses of the drug cyclosporine that was being used. So we developed a new anti-rejection protocol that was more tailored to the needs of an islet transplant that would be less diabetogenic and would hopefully be far more effective in preventing both attack from the alloimmune process, the rejection process that normally occurs in a transplant patient, as well as the particular challenge in a patient receiving a transplant who has type 1 diabetes, the autoimmune process. We have to prevent both the autoimmune and the alloimmune attack. And we hoped that the Edmonton Protocol combination of the drugs tacrolimus in low dose and sirolimus, another anti-rejection drug, together with an antibody given at the beginning called teclizumab, would help. And the results were absolutely astounding to us. We were not expecting patients to be completely off insulin, but all of our seven patients first treated with that therapy were completely insulin-free when at the time we reported in the year 2000. And so we then moved forward into 2006 with this multi-center trial.
And so now it is 6 years later, it's 2006, and can you discuss what this particular study design was, what the model you were using, the hypothesis or assumptions you were applying to this particular research, and what the outcomes were?
Sure. The hypothesis really was, first question, was the Edmonton Protocol, our results from 2000, was it possible to replicate them in other centers? And at the point we designed the trial in 1999, you have to imagine that a huge amount of effort and endeavor went into moving forward an international multi-center trial in islet transplantation. And this is a landmark trial in 2006 because it's the very first ever international multi-center trial ever to be conducted, in fact, in islet transplantation. So the hypothesis, could we replicate the success that we had in one center across these other centers? But there was also another background behind this. This trial was funded by the Immune Tolerance Network as well as the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. And the facets behind the Immune Tolerance Network is that this group of scientists hope one day to be able to do transplants without the need for anti-rejection drugs. In other words, be able to trick the immune system to not recognize a foreign tissue as being foreign and therefore prevent the rejection. It's called tolerance. So the Immune Tolerance Network was really hoping that we'd be able to set up 8 or 9 different international sites where they could then test in subsequent trials some immune intervention strategies that would induce tolerance for an islet transplanted patient. So we moved forward, and the trial was designed. It wasn't a huge trial. It was a very expensive trial to put together, but not a huge trial. There were 36 patients in total, and we chose to do a maximum of 4 patients at each of the 9 sites. So there were many logistical nightmares, as you perhaps can imagine, when you try and replicate a protocol in many different sites. And one of the first challenges we had was that some sites knew how to make islets, knew how to extract the islets from the pancreas, and we could talk about the details of that process a bit if you like. But the other sites were learning that brand new, so they had to learn. They were right at the beginning of the learning curve in the first 4 patients. And then on the other hand, on the clinical side, some centers had experience with some of these newer anti-rejection drugs, such as sirolimus, in other transplanted patients, as in fact our own center had in about 50 liver transplant patients. But other sites were using the drug sirolimus for the very first time and really weren't familiar with how to monitor the drug levels, how to adjust for any side effects. So as a result of that, I guess the findings of this study were not that surprising in that we found that some sites could replicate the Edmonton Protocol very successfully. Mm-hmm. Other sites really struggled.